Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today I have Jared Parsons. He's the lead on the C-sharp compiler team, but I understand that he does a whole lot more than that. Jared, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. So what are the roles that you play with C-sharp 9?
So I'm the dev lead on the C-sharp compiler team, which means I oversee the actual compiler bits, what the implementation of the C-sharp, coordinating all our features and as well as the .NET SDK. I'm also a member of the C-sharp language design, and that means that I'm part of the body that sits and helps set the direction of C-sharp. We do a lot of discussions on what should we do, what kind of themes should we have in a piece, and how do we get it all together to a coherent product today for every C-sharp.
Well, I'll start by saying that for a 20-year-old language, the improvements are coming fast and furious.
Yes.
We're barely getting our head around C-sharp 7. Now I've been doing a brief presentation on what's new in C-sharp 8, and C-sharp 9 is being fleshed out even as we speak.
Yeah, and I think that that's it's an overall reflection with how .NET has changed, particularly as we embrace .NET Core. And since .NET Core has essentially, it has a much more rapid cycle than .NET Framework. .NET Framework was slowed at times because it shipped inside of Windows. And that meant that whenever we had an update to .NET, it was going to ship inside of Windows. And that means you were going to push all of your changes to billions of devices around them. And that is cool, but that is also super intimidating, is that the chance you will break someone, it's not high, it's at that scale. And so that for a while that pushes you into a model where you end up having a little bit slower of release cycles, so you can have crazy amounts of validation. Where .NET Core, it's a much more flexible release cycle. It's something where we've established a cadence that we're trying to get versions out about once a year is the cadence we have now. And we attempt to pair versions of C-sharp with major versions of .NET Core. And so that we can have this nice big point for the entire .NET system in one place. It's no longer .NET Framework here, and then we move C-sharp a few months later. It's no. Every at a very predictable cycle, we're going to be .NET system on stuff. And that does mean that we end up having much more rapid use of C-sharp.
Right, which does mean that I end up having a nervous breakdown.
Well, yeah, I can tell you on the other side of making sure that we can get all of these big features into these smaller windows, it can sometimes give me a bit of a...
Why don't we dive in and talk a little bit about what's coming in C-sharp 9? And do you want to start by talking about how definite any of this is?
So everything I'm talking about today is what I would say is on very likely scale. I always say very likely because in C-sharp, until we have actually shipped a feature and we have labeled it as a part of the RTM shipping bits, we can yank them at the last second. And historically, we have done that, even for features we thought had to definitely do. Two great examples I bring up those. I go back to about C-sharp 6. Up until the last minute, we had things like we had a version of primary constructors and we had a version of parameterless structures. And those got yanked out very late in the product side. And that's because we ended up finding some very bad problems with those and how they interact with bigger ecosystem. And it forced our hand, I guess, at the same time.
What happened to those poor features?
They are actually, both of them are something we're still considering versions of C-sharp. As part of diving into records, for instance, has forced us to re-examine primary constructors and what their role in language. And I think it's very likely that we'll take a serious push at those, either as a part of C-sharp 9 or C-sharp.
Okay. I'm going to continually ask you as you go about some of the terms that you're using. Example, primary constructor.
So primary constructor. That's a term that it's hard to give you a great example of it because it's a feature we haven't shipped yet. But primary constructors are the idea of saying that can I just include the constructor definition in the declaration class? And for instance, instead of having a typical class, and you repeat the name of the class and constructor, and you'll add a bunch of arguments and then assign those parameters and fields or properties. A primary constructor is a way of saying, hey, could I just do that all at once? Could I just declare my type, say open paren, and just list out the things? And
so it sounds very similar to what happens in TypeScript.
Yes. It's a feature that we have definitely drawn from other languages like TypeScript. F-sharp is another language which has these very similar.
I have a short list of topics which I suspect are going to have long answers. Ooh. So why don't we talk with source generator?
Yes, source generators. So source generators is a feature that when you're building your product, like source generators are a way where library authors can essentially define pieces of code which generate code specific to your project. It's the idea of like library authors can say like, hey, if I only knew if the code was doing X or Y, or if it had type these names, I could make my library that much better. And generators are a way basically hooking library authors into the build process so that they can inspect the code they built and generate code that supports their library. And source generators are something that you actually have a lot of today, you're probably just kind of unaware of. For instance, generators that probably most C# customers use at some time are like the ResX. If you've ever essentially had a ResX file in your project, use that nice designer Visual Studio where you can set names and values and images. The way that's implemented under the hood is this source generator. It looks at a ResX file, it looks at some property project file, it generates this code under the hood kind of together. It's inspecting the parts of your build, generating code that makes your development experience better. WinForms and WPF in particular is another example. In order to generate kind of some of the startup code for WPF, they actually have to be able to inspect and look at the types in your project, kind of build on top of those and generate some of their supporting code under the hood, like all these CS files in your options. Razor products is another one, like the way tag helpers work by they kind of inspect the code compile, they pull out those tag helpers, they generate some supporting code on the side, recompile your application, all that stuff. The problem with source generators today is all of this inspection and all of this code generation, it's extremely ad hoc. Most of the generators work by creating us. And what that means is they don't have a lot of data. They can, at the high end of gen, they will essentially say like, well, I can look at all the source files and I can look at most of the refs. And then I could write my own C# parser and inspect the code of C. Or if you look at like, and what that means though, is like, they don't get rich type data. Like they can't essentially open up a C# file. They can't say what types are used. Give me like almost kind of reflection-based model code where I can see what memories types have. Is this a string or is this some other type aware of? They can't get that rich information. And generators, they often find that they need that information itself. Like if you look at how WPF and Razor work, look, they actually, in the process of the Razor pages, they actually do a separate build behind the scenes where they create a smaller version of the application so that they can then load that assembly, do some reflection on it, get this rich type information, generate the files.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's, and actually source, I'll talk about Razor a little bit later. About how that kind of fit in this story. And what source generators is trying to make that get rid of all of that ad hocness and make it first class part of the pilot. So first off, like what we're doing, most users by now are from analyzers. Analyzers are a way that library authors can augment C# today. They can essentially define custom diagnostics to say like, hey, like XUnit is a great library for essentially analyze. XUnit will tell you all these great things you build against it. It'll say, hey, you have a public method. You forgot to put fact. This probably isn't one. Or it'll tell you like, hey, you're using assert.equal. You'd be using assert.single, .empty. It's a very beautiful way of kind of looking at your usage of their library, telling you. And the way analyzers work is the Roslyn compiler, the C# compiler these days, we have a rich API about the compilation experience. It can tell you source files, it tells you all of the references, and it gives you this beautiful symbol model on top. And the way we are implementing generators is we are simply sitting on top of all the work today. We are essentially telling library authors, hey, if you've written an analyzer, you know how to export like essentially an analyzer for some compiler. Now you can also export a generator. And a generator hooks in the same way. We're going to give you a compilation. And that compilation gives you access to everything the C# compiler is using to compile that program. And then you can give us back a set of files. And we were going to then take these C# files that you generate, and we will include them in the compilation disk. And this is going to be a huge step up for the way source. Because first off, it gets rid of all this MS Build hacking that we're today in order to plug. And most of this hackery, we can actually look at the evolution, talk to customers, where it's like, ah, you started your generator by looking at ResGen, did it? Because we can see we copied all of their MS Build and pasted it to your application. Because we fixed a few bugs over there, but we haven't fixed, you don't have the same bug fix that test. It gets rid of all of that and just says, hey, if you know how to build analyze, then you know how to build source. The other advantage is because it's all happening within the compiler, we can optimize significantly because the compiler today is very optimized for this server build put scenarios. We implement a lot of DLL caching, we have a lot of symbol caching, and today generators get none of it. But once they get into the compilation, they get to hook to that generator's cluster. And we think that generators have a very big role to see because there's lots of scenarios every day we see generators.
But this, if I understand you, would be for people who are creating libraries.
Correct. it would be for library authors to say, how can this be? So a couple examples of like this massive, like one of them is regular expressions. So the way regular expression is there's a line, you give it a text and you say, hey, I want to create a regex over this. And then under the hood, it has to generate a whole bunch of data. It essentially has to parse the regex, it has to define all of the context-free grammars and underlying data structures to support expression. But it has to do this at runtime. And it will then, if you've ever used regex, you know, there are options like compile, where it'll take the result of all of this, it'll generate some IL, it'll compile it kind of, it'll emit IL at runtime, it'll load that into the assembly process, and all of that has to happen before your regex does. And it also means that this happens every single time you start your application. All this work to parse under regex is just done over, and it can impact like the performance of it. And really, your regexes, they probably don't change a lot. They're probably the same regex. You probably have written a few regexes and they lived in your app, but you're paying this cost. Whereas with SourceJS, we have an opportunity to say, hey, this is the regex I'm going to use. Could you just generate all that code and compile? Could you do all of that parsing? You do all of that logic and just emit it as C# form. Save me all that runtime parsing, you know, startup, and just get this done. Compile. And we think that that particular has potential to really impact our regular expression, which is something focusing on a lot in .NET 5. Another scenario that we talk a lot about is kind of how can we use SourceJS to avoid flexion occasions? And one way to think about that is serials. So today, like if you have like a deserializer pattern, a JSON deserializer, Soft, XML, what have you, those are almost entirely flexion. Take in an object, query for its type, they say, okay, what member there? And now let me use like property.get.set, like these objects. Well, the reason they have to do that is because they have to support every object being an ecosystem. In your particular application, there's a finite set of things that you're going to be using in serial. So what serializers could do is they can, for instance, say, like, let me just look at all the places where serialize or deserialize is called, and let me see what types are. And once I know what those are, instead of generating all this reflection runtime, why don't I just write out C#, which just takes values and sets them props? Let me just take all of that, write it out, have it compiled in the application, and then I don't have to do all this discovery at runtime. I don't have flexion at runtime. I don't have to have essentially a negative impact to Jetty because you can't optimize reflection as well as you can optimize create with C#. And so this has a chance, particularly with like the JSON serializer in Work 5, to mean our the serializer's complete reflection. It could just be using straight line C# code generated at build time to manipulate these objects.
Yeah, I was going to say that should have a huge impact on performance.
Yeah.
Well, I like your enthusiasm about it, but since I'm not a library author, let me bring you towards kinds of things that potentially I would be.
Okay.
Now, I went to one of the webinar presentations and records came up. And unfortunately, the discussion started out with the assumption that you knew what records were and why they were cool. But maybe you could tell me about that before you tell me about what if it will be in 9.
So records. So I think the way to kind of talk to you about like why it's cool is to start off kind of like a different discussion. I want to talk about a data type. Pretty much any listener is familiar with this. Essentially, let's talk about the data type point. So a point on an axis. So you have an X and a Y. Now, let's talk about as a C# author, what do you need to write a successful, especially for one, like these days, more immutable data structure. So let's kind of walk what all you find point to make sure it's fully compatible with both all of the stuff that C# is trying, as well as compatible with .NESD experience. So the first thing you're going to do is you're going to say, okay, well, it's a point. It's an X and Y. So I'm going to define two properties, int X and int Y, and get accessor because we build it. So because you've done this, now you've basically forced another decision. You can't use object initialize. So now you need to go write a constructor to initialize these values. And so that constructor is also you have an X and a Y parameter. And then it's going to basically say that for every person, this dot X is X, this dot Y.
Let me interrupt. And I definitely want to follow the thread of this, but the premise is that you want an immutable object. Mm-hmm. And so either now or later, we should talk for a couple minutes about why. Why do you want immutable?
Absolutely. Do you want to follow up with that now, or you want to?
Yeah, why don't we do that if you can remember where you're up to in the story, which is creating a point. One of the things you said about creating a point is you want it to be immutable.
And so the reason why you prefer data is immutable data. So the problem with immutable is it carries with it a lot of responsibility. When you're passing immutable data, you have to be very questions like who is allowed to change, who can change this data. If I pass this value to that, this function there, is it going to change the things that I depend on, things that I found important? Is it all of that in such such a way that I need to guard against it. Do I need to save the name of this person before I hand it to the save operation? Or can I depend on it being that it's done? And what that really kind of boils down to is it means you have to have a lot of communication about responsibility, about who can change this. And every time you have to depend on communication and kind of documentation for success, and also as you get more and more into multi-threaded programming, async, mutability becomes even harder to talk because then you have to worry about race. Whereas immutable data is significantly easier because I don't have to worry about who will or who won't change my data. None of them. Once constructed, right, my object is immutable. Change. So I can hand this object off to everyone else in my program uses it, and I don't have to worry about will they use that value irresponsibly? Will they break that I have? It's immutable. It will always be the same. And so it's just, it frees up your brain to think about the actual function of your application instead of, are the different parts of my application handling this data?
Right. Okay, great. So that brings us back to the...
Yeah, and so with the point, as we were saying, once you have data, you have for every piece of data, you end up having to say the name four different times. You have to say int x in the property. You have to say int x in the constructor parameter, and then you have to assign the proper constructor, this.x equals x. And so it becomes a bit, for x and y, it's not that deal. You only have to write times. Still a lot. Now, the next thing you'd probably say point is if I want to be a part of the .NET experience, the .NET SDK experience, I need them. And so that means I have to get hash code. And that get hash code has to essentially use all the best practices around how to combine hash code, effectively the combinators on them. And I have to make sure to respect all of the different members of my type. You also have to define an equal. And if you're implementing a class, you probably want to define operators, operator not, because at the point you have value call, you want to make sure the overrides operator accidentally get reference call. You also probably then need to implement the iEquitable interface. And if you actually write all of this out for just a simple type of two, implementing all of equality, it ends up burning up a significant amount. You're probably talking somewhere, depending on your styles, somewhere around 75 of this stuff, depending on what size. And then you have other C sharps, do I want my type construction? And so deconstruction is something that's somewhat new to C sharp. You essentially take a type and say, can you break it down into a series of values? For a point, a point is primarily two values, x and y. And if you implement deconstruction, that means in C sharp, you can actually say var open print x comma y equals some point, and we'll take those two values, pull them out of the point, and assign two locals in. And you can just go on and on. And when you really kind of step back and look at this simple little thing, which is just an x and a y, you end up having to find about 100 lines of code to get this done. It becomes a very large piece of code, and so simple. And the worst is it gets even worse when you think about type evolution. Today your point is an x and y. If you eventually decide I want to add a z in, that means number one, you have to repeat all this. And number two, you have to go back to every one of these members and remember, I implemented a call. Therefore, if I add a new member, I have to make sure that I go and call it. Because if you just add int z point, you're not going to get this. No one's going to tell you you forgot the quality. You didn't put in your hash code. You didn't add z construction. You're not going to get into that because that's not a part of how the class does. And records in a lot of ways. Oh, and then the other thing is, if you have an immutable point, how do you modify? How do you say hey, I know this point has whatever values of x and y. I want to change. I want y to become 30, but I want to keep the same value x. I just want to take this one little property and change it. How can I, with an immutable type, that means generally you're going to have to say new point. You're going to say old point dot x comma essentially 30. For point, it's not that. For point, that's a simple operator to talk about. But when you start talking about records, we have dozens of members. You're talking about having to repeat tons and tons and tons of information just to change a single. And records are essentially that a lot of what we talked about all the work classes today is because C-sharp types are essentially, we give you the tools. We'll say, hey, this is how you define it. This is how you limit it. This is what all it means. You can do whatever you want. You can add all these, you can take this, you can take that, put them all together in any way. Records are a way of kind of a different way. They're very opinionated. They're saying, hey, I want, a record is saying, I want the part of the C-sharp experience, the .NET experience. I want to get much out of my system. And so in the most distilled form of records, the way you declare a record point, you say record class point index semicolon int y semicolon. It's, I don't know how many letters that is, but it's about 20. And what C-sharp is going to do under the hood is it's going to say, I know what look, I know they want. I'm going to give your get properties using this new feature for how we allow the ability to object. I'm going to generate, I'm going to interfaces. I'm going to do all of this work for you because you have, by object, you have just said, all of these data, all this data, my type defines my type. So just do all the work, implement all the cool C, implementing construction. And it also gives us a couple of features that can't be seen. For one, when I talk about when you want to mutate, that's always about creating a copy and saying, take this thing, create a copy, and set all the, with records. records, though, we're getting past all that problems you have with having two or so. You have to create a new type and you say, here are the 12 old values and I want to change. Instead, we're introducing this feature called withers, where you can say you take a point.
All right, what's the word?
Withers. So like W-I-T-H-E-R, withers. What it's doing is you can say, like, you basically take an expression and say point with. And what that is doing is saying, and after that, you essentially find an opposite. You can say point with open brace, Y close brace. And what that will do under the hood is say that everything you change in that with, we will take the original, whatever point was on the left-hand side, we will take all of the values that were in that and we will keep them except for the ones that you change. So that would say, keep like a essentially point with Y equals 13, would say, okay, keep X, but assign Y to. And this will do all the work under the hood of creating a copy, assigning old values over, and also assigning. And it's this nice, convenient, succinct syntax, which is kind of this. And I have harped on immutability a bit. Immutability is simply kind of like default of records. If you wanted to find a record which is completely mutable, like there are various little annotations you can put to make sure that record will record. But we are defaulting to the ability because I feel like that kind of goes to, or at least a lot of programs.
It's beginning to look different from the C# we all...
I actually started coding C# as a research assistant in college, and that was more C# 1. So I've seen about every version of C#. It's when I think back to like all the things I was in, a lot of it is the same, but there is a lot of it definitely different. And in a nice way, like I really enjoy a lot of these.
But from what you're describing, records are pretty radical change from what I'm used to doing in C#. Yeah. So can you give me a couple more examples, real world examples of where I would say, oh, I know what I need a record.
I would say that like, when would you need a record? I would also go back and say it's like all looking at like good examples of where I like, it's like I write lots of, you have all these transitions because usually you like take in a model that JSON, I redefine a lot of my JSON objects, my JSON serialization objects, defining as records. Like essentially those are types where if you want to like JSON objects, that's a place where you've probably repeated yourself a lot. All these little simple struct types that you used as like kind of addition types of records. And pretty much everything I've done up until this point where I'm quality, I would probably, because it's just so usable. And even in the case of you didn't necessarily want the quality, it's like records are much more concise when it's used, especially for just the simple little pieces of data passed around your app. The amount of code you have to write to find a wealth is dramatically simpler than what you would write, particularly for these simples.
And can your records also have methods?
Yes, you can augment them with instance methods. I mean, under the hood, they are actually just classes or structs, whichever. So you can add method, add their own properties, which aggregate. And that's actually an important thing to get into, is that records in a lot of ways are just syntax. And we believe that's really important because we really see records as kind of grow-up stories. So we want people to really come with the idea of saying, I'm starting a data type. It's kind of simple. It might get really complex, but I'm not afraid to find it as of now because I can always make it. Everything we're doing is from the consumption side, from the way that people interact. So essentially, customers get a whole type file in terms of the ability to use, have the easy construction, have all of the quality. They are going to kind of, whether or not that is implemented as a record or C#, they are none the wiser. Because what we want is for people to define things as, and keep it as a record as long as it works. But because records are, they do things have like generated quality for every, always implement these methods. It is possible at some point, type author will say, you know what, that was great for a long time, but now I want to have a little more say in how this is done, and I want more say in how all these work, because maybe the one size fits all just doesn't meet with me anymore because my type's gotten complex. In our vision, you just open up Visual Studio, you right click and say, make it a class. And it will then take your record definition and expand it out into a simple class. And that will have all of the semantics that your old record has. So it doesn't break anything about the experience for all the people. It just says, okay, I want more control.
That's great. That's very exciting. I'm going to need to see that in use. I'm going to see written examples that I can scratch my head over. That does sound, and as I remember, the people who were involved in this webinar and the people who were leaving questions are very excited to see you having records. I take it it existed in other languages first.
Yes, absolutely. You can look in some ways, like if you ever done like JavaScript, like kind of the most succinct, the succinct definitions they have are very simple ways of data. Probably closer equivalent is like F-sharp records. F-sharp has a very specific record syntax, and they have a huge amount of syntactical records. And so this is not necessarily a concept. It's something kind of wanted to do. If you actually go back in time, just like source generators, records is actually something we started talking about many years ago. I think probably about 5 or 6 years we started talking records, but it's essentially taken us this long just kind of get up on our priority list, meet all the scenarios, the other scenarios we're working on, and kind of get to orphanage.